This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people, some at the top of their game, others still climbing, all possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their visions. I'm not a journalist. I'm a deep thinker, a conversationalist. I won't be engaging my guests as a passive, neutral moderator. I have a perspective, an opinion on just about everything. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives. In this space, I hope to deepen, broaden, and sometimes even shift my own opinion by opening myself up to the thoughtful insights of others. I invite you to join me on this journey.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
Josh Levine, executive editor of Slate Magazine, wrote a jaw-dropping story at the end of 2013 probing the life of Linda Taylor, the woman who he discovered was the actual welfare queen, the toxic, living high on the hog off the government's dime stereotype, who became emblazoned in the American imagination after her exploits were chronicled in Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign speech. While many believed she was a politically motivated fabrication, her fraud was very real and chronicled in great detail in the Chicago Tribune. The welfare queen in the minds of most is thought to be a black woman. However, Levine's article details the life of a woman who on her birth and death certificates was actually codified as white, but use multiple racial identities and names regularly to commit crimes far more damning than public aid fraud. And she even has a connection to singer R. Kelly, whose documented questionable relationships with underage girls is finally getting the amount of scrutiny it never received when the first accusations were lodged against him decades ago. Josh, welcome to the AYG List.
Thank you so much for having me.
At the end of last year, while in the midst of holiday merrymaking, I stumbled upon your article, The Welfare Queen, on Slate. The headline and picture grabbed my attention, and I started to read what I thought would be a brief piece while baking for the holidays. After the first three paragraphs, I realized that your article was a significant treatment of the matter, and I decided to stop trying to multitask and give it my full attention. Upon completion, I knew that I had just read the most important piece of journalism I had encountered in 2013 and immediately started to share it via my social media platforms. I tagged several of my friends who were scholars teaching various disciplines in the academy, asking them for their take on what you presented. Many of them took their time to process all you shared before attempting to unpack how it interrogates, complicates, and implies notions about who we are, who and what we value, what shapes public policy, who gets to shape the public narrative, and, in the long and short run, if we even care to know the truth. I want to start my interview with you from a different place. How did you come to be a journalist, and based on what hopes for professional fulfillment and success?
Well, first, let me thank you so much for the kind words and for sharing the story with so many people. I also hope that you remember to turn your oven off after you started reading the piece.
I was going to burn some pies because I was transfixed. I mean, I have never read a piece in probably the last 5 or so years where I thought it was going to be a brief piece and who knew if it was going to be politically toxic or whatever, but just had me transfixed and mesmerized. So thank you so much for writing a good piece of journalism.
Oh, well, thank you. I got my start in journalism out of college. I had actually majored in computer science in school and kind of fascinated the logical part of my brain, but then I decided that it didn't really give me the fulfillment that I was looking for. I got a little bored with programming. And so, you know, I'd always really liked to write, and it was something that I sort of pursued from there, mostly because I really like to tell stories about people, and Linda Taylor, the welfare queen, was sort of the most fascinating person that I've encountered in my years of journalism.
You serve as the executive editor of Slate Magazine, primarily focused on sports and the technology, but I know that you've got the chops for bringing to fruition significant stories from your award-winning piece, Off Target, that aided in exposing the Jason Blair plagiarism scandal. I was really curious, though, how this story about the woman who was codified as the original welfare queen had come to your attention as something worthy for deeper investigation.
A friend of mine actually told me that there was a real person attached to the welfare queen stereotype, that there had been kind of the patient zero for this term. It was something that I wasn't really aware of. I'd obviously heard the phrase before and knew how loaded it was and the historical baggage that it had. So when I knew that there was an origin story behind it, I just really wanted to figure out who this person was, like tell the story of the real human being that launched this phrase that's become so pervasive in our culture. So I didn't really know where that was going to take me. I certainly didn't know that she had the background that she did, but I figured that there was probably a good story in there somewhere. I just didn't really know how good it was going to be, I think.
Yeah. I believe you were born in 1980, am I correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So you were a child during the Reagan era. I was wondering, while pulling together your exquisite piece, did anything about your lived experience during that time strike you?
I was actually a little bit too young, I think. The first president that I really associate with my childhood is, the first Bush. But we all have this sort of experience, I think, of Reagan based on, what's been written about him, how he's been portrayed in the media, and, what we've all read about him. And so I felt like I certainly had a good image of him in my mind, or sort of beliefs about him and what he stood for. And so that was also interesting to kind of be able to dig a little bit deeper and try to figure out what he was about, as well as trying to figure out who Linda Taylor was.
Did any of that, any of what you learned during your research, shape the foundations of how you came to understand others, or that shaped certain prevailing notions that you had at the time that have shifted after you've done this piece?
Yeah, so one kind of big debate that was had back then and continues now, and in the wake of my story, a lot of people have been talking about this, is what Reagan's intentions were when he would talk about Linda Taylor. I didn't get into this that much in the story, but a lot of the Reagan folks that I talked to were very adamant that he was not a racist person and that he didn't intend to bring up this woman's story, the 80 names, the $150,000, this woman in Chicago, that was not racial code. There are people on the other side who certainly believe the opposite. And I think I came to the conclusion that based on the history of how welfare was talked about in the 60s, the 50s, even before Reagan, that it would be hard for any kind of politician to say the things that he said without knowing that there would be racial connotations to it. So that was one thing that I was definitely interested in looking at.
Yeah, I think we're going to get back to that, because I kind of anticipated, after we went through the story of Linda Taylor for our listeners, that we would kind of get back to you how it's being used as a political football in a way, now that you've kind of brought it to light. Let's zero in on this fascinating Linda Taylor. This woman you've identified through much research as the person who Ronald Reagan used as an example for a public aid fraud run amok. Paint us a picture of how she was used not only by Reagan, but by the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer George Bliss in the Chicago Tribune, who seemed to have, in a way, struck a nerve, but also struck gold by codifying the fears and frustration of that conservative-leaning era. First, share how they define the traits of a welfare queen, and second, share how Linda Taylor was, for them, the ultimate personification of the term.
Yeah, this was a time in the mid-70s when the economy wasn't doing so well. There was a lot of anxiety among lower-class or middle-class people about their economic lot and, just how they were doing and able to survive in this climate. The idea that there were people out there who were not working and were able to live high on the hog was, I think, very offensive to people, and also something that it just really, for whatever reason, even if it wasn't true, it really rang true to a lot of people, just this idea that I'm out there working really hard and I'm having a struggle even being able to put food on the table, but there are all these other people out there who are not working hard like I am. And so this was a very powerful populist message for politicians and for journalists, I think. So I think what Reagan was doing in talking about this woman in Chicago who used 80 names, 30 social security numbers, had $150,000 a year in tax-free annual income. What he was trying to do was get people to align against a common enemy and to basically recruit voters to his side by saying that I'm the one to fix this. I'm the welfare is the reason why you're having problems. The people taking advantage of welfare is something that I'm going to step in and stop when I'm elected president. And as far as the Chicago Tribune, you know, George Bliss had been writing about statewide fraud and public aid programs for a while, and he had documented it, and there was, you know, the stuff certainly existed. There were problems with the public aid programs and the state of Illinois. But it wasn't something that readers of a daily newspaper were really going to get that agitated about, like a headline about state Medicaid fraud. You know, it's not something that you're really going to stop over and get outraged about. But when you can personify that fraud, when you can make it seem like something that hits closer to home, that there's a woman wearing fur coats and driving Cadillacs who's stealing your money, you know, your tax dollars, that's something that I think really angered people and was a story that they just kept coming back to because it was so powerful, so successful.
During the height of her infamy, Linda Taylor gave the Chicago Tribune and many other media outlets much material to paint a pretty toxic picture of this social caricature for which the public seemed to have an endless appetite. But as much as the public knew, they really didn't know the half. Your piece explains in mind-boggling detail that the welfare fraud was the least of her crimes. Talk with me about her multiple identities, how she seemed to change her race and her age as often as most women change their shoes, and her other more troubling criminal activity that just really never seemed to come to the fore.
Right. So when this was written about her changing her identities, her age, and her race by the Tribune and by other outlets, it was presented kind of in the context of this is what she would do in order to be more effective at stealing welfare money. In fact, this was just part of a kind of larger criminal enterprise, that she would present herself as a different person to different people that she would meet in her life. And this was something that happened over decades, not just over years. And it wasn't just welfare. She was accused over the decades of kidnapping, of selling children, of homicide, and these were things that were actually investigated by police, by the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, things that she was never charged for. And I sort of go through the reasons why she wasn't charged and present the strong evidence that she probably was involved in these other crimes.
One of them that I found just, well, there were so many compelling ones. There was the one where she was accused of poisoning the mother of these two kids that she basically left indigent. And then there was the Franzak kidnapping. Can you go into detail about those two cases?
Yeah, the first one that you're mentioning was this woman named Patricia Parks, who she met, befriended around 1974-75. And she moved into Patricia Parks's house, serving as a nanny, babysitter, housekeeper type figure. And Patricia Parks's daughter told me that the circumstances of the family like changed pretty drastically as soon as Linda Taylor moved in, that they had a, you know, relatively posh upbringing, that they used to shop in fancy department stores downtown. They went to Montessori school, and then immediately they didn't have enough food to eat. They didn't hang out with any of the mother's friends. They stopped going to church. And her mother just started getting sicker and sicker and sicker and eventually died. She had been healthy before Linda Taylor moved in. And, you know, on her death certificate, it lists barbiturate overdose as the cause of death. So the Franzak kidnapping, in that case, it was 1964, and this was a case that fascinated Chicago and the entire country, really. There was a child stolen from his mother's arms in a Chicago hospital a day or two after he was born. A woman in a nurse's uniform took the child, said that he needed to be examined by a doctor, and then the woman left out of a rear exit. The child vanished, and there was a huge manhunt. More than 30,000 people were interviewed, but they never found the woman dressed as a nurse. They never found the child, and Linda Taylor was seen as a suspect in that case as well.
And you also detail other accounts of people saying that they were in her presence and she was always in the company of a child that wasn't her own, and then that the child would mysteriously disappear. So to be clear, in addition to public aid fraud, the person that was popularized as Linda Taylor was also believed to have been a murderer, a kidnapper, and a baby trafficker, and that this was known both by law enforcement and some in the media. What in your mind happened here? It just seems so incredibly far-fetched for most people who read the article and people who will come to read the article after we share this interview. Why was the welfare fraud the primary story about a woman who was clearly a skilled professional criminal?
Jack Sherwin, the detective who was really the person in the Chicago Police Department who was the most focused on trying to bring her to justice, He believes that after the story hit the Chicago Tribune and after she was identified as the welfare queen, like, that was the reason that everyone became fixated on the welfare part of the equation. Mm-hmm. There was a state senator in Illinois who detailed Sherwin and his partner to a special legislative commission to investigate the welfare part of her criminality. And it just sort of took on a life of its own, that there were all these different constituencies, politicians, the newspaper, the prosecutors, who once this story became big, it was in their best interest, they believed, to really just nail her for that part of her criminal career. And the man who prosecuted her for welfare fraud told me that he believed, and I don't know if this would have been true or not, that if he had charged her for the Patricia Parks homicide, that it would have been perceived that he was just trying to bring more attention for the welfare fraud charges, that it would have distracted from that case, and that there was more evidence to convict her. He just didn't feel like he had enough evidence to convict for the homicide. So I think a lot of different people have a lot of different beliefs for why what transpired, but all of it in hindsight just seems absurd that
the
welfare charges are what ended up being the focus.
You informed us in the piece that she served time for the welfare fraud and perjury, but was never touched for the alleged murders or kidnappings, even with the incredible evidence that you were able to uncover. This is touchy, but if we were to point fingers here and hold someone accountable for this, who should that be? And you mentioned a few people, but are there folks who tried to tie all of this together whose efforts were rebuffed? And it seems to me that that is clearly the case. It seems to me like it's incredible political hubris and incompetence, but it goes back to you illuminating that at the time, you could not tell people who sort of had these conservative notions about policy, who the population was at the source of the problem, that this stuff wasn't really raging with sort of like racial undertones. Is there equal blame to go around with law enforcement and with policymakers? How are you meeting that out?
Yeah, I think that the Chicago Police Department made major mistakes in how they handled the case. As I said before, they allowed Jack Sherwin, who investigated her, and his partner to be detailed to this legislative commission that was strictly focused on welfare fraud rather than allowing Sherwin to focus on her alleged homicide. So that they seem to show more interest or willingness to allow the main detective on the case to look at the welfare stuff rather than the homicide. So that's a choice that I think we can look at and say that doesn't really make sense.
I
think that there were certainly politicians who seized on this woman as an example of somebody who could be used to make a certain kind of appeal to voters, but there just wasn't really any kind of sweeping movement, whether it was by law enforcement or politicians, to make this woman an example of somebody who was maybe a psychopath. So I just think that she was just somebody who could be useful to a lot of people, you know, to stand for something that she wasn't. And nobody really seemed that interested in really drilling down to figure out who she was as a person rather than as a symbol.
In your article, you write so nicely about how she was so flamboyant. I mean, she really played to the stereotypes.
Yeah, she did. I mean, she did have the Cadillac. You can't deny it. She had the Cadillac.
Yeah. She had the Cadillac and the furs.
You know, it's an interesting, it's a very, like, nuanced kind of point, and I think it's one that people who have different political leanings can seize on one side or the other. She did commit welfare fraud. I mean, that's something that is undeniable. And a lot of people in reading the story have said, oh, well, Reagan was right. You know, Reagan said that she did these things and she did do these things. And if you look at it in the kind of narrow sense, then that's absolutely true. The point is that she does not stand for anything. She is Absolutely. Herself. And what she showed was that if somebody is a dedicated criminal, somebody who, you know, I would argue is one of the more impressive criminals of our time, somebody who is that dedicated could take advantage of the public aid system circa the 1970s. But her case does not show, it shows quite the opposite, that she was not a garden variety criminal. Mm-hmm. She's not somebody who is really emblematic of what was happening, you know, across the entire system.
Right, right. If we were to produce a timeline, like, off the cuff, it seems that the Tribune codified the term welfare queen when?
74.
74. And then public policy debates about the welfare mess. They were pretty intense during the 60s, right?
Yeah, so Reagan certainly wasn't the first one to use anecdotes like this. I mean, there were hearings. Robert Byrd, the senator from West Virginia, former Ku Klux Klan member, held hearings in Congress in the 60s about the Washington, D.C. social aid programs that were very racially charged and emphasizing the fact of his view that women receiving, you know, aid for dependent children were just spending the money on their paramours and were spending the money on alcohol and all this, like, very racially charged rhetoric. So, yeah, that was all happening kind of in the 60s after after African Americans started getting benefits that had long been denied to them.
Right. And then before that, the Housing Act of 1949, I think, actually forbade men from living in the home where a woman was receiving government assistance. So we're really talking about a time of persistent social, political, economic disintegration for Black people embedded in public policies that were draconian towards Black people and the poor, to say the very, very least. In my mind, is there a policy myth here that needs to be debunked with regard to the perceived persistence of welfare fraud and who commits welfare fraud? So I think part of what you troubled in some of the stuff that I read about your telling is that for all of the making of this myth about the welfare queen and all that went into that definition, that the incidences of actual public aid fraud were exaggerated by her as a person, but across the board were not as intense as codified. But the other question I have is, if it is that easy to commit welfare fraud, shouldn't the policy's application and refinement be the focus rather than criminalizing an entire swath of people to cover up that kind of incompetence?
Yeah, I mean, you ask a lot of really good questions there, so let me try to dip in and out here and see what I can answer. As far as the incidence of welfare fraud, anecdote has been cited a lot more often than research, and I think part of that is because anecdote is really powerful, and part of that is that legitimately the numbers are very hard to get at. That when you say that there's welfare fraud, so what does that mean? Like, a lot of times people lump in just errors, like if somebody makes an innocent mistake, or how do you even tease out what's a mistake and what's willful fraud? And estimates that I've seen range anywhere from 3% to 25% of public aid spending goes to fraud. And so with a range that big, I don't think that it's really, it's just really hard to say how big of a problem it is. But I think it's also, I haven't seen any evidence that the level of fraud and wastefulness in social welfare programs is any higher than in any other program. You know, if you look at wastefulness in defense contracting, for example. So I think a lot of the heated rhetoric about this, it's coming from someplace else. It's not it's not about the pure dollars. It's about seeing this as a some larger political issue that can be taken advantage of, or that just offends people for whatever reason.
I think you did a good job of saying this. There's a certain part of this myth that does need to be debunked. Was Linda Taylor, the person that they codified as the original welfare queen, a person who committed welfare fraud? Yes. Okay. But then we go back to the way that not only the Tribune and its writers and Reagan kind of codified the definition of what a welfare queen is, who she is, how she operates, and how that has become the larger narrative. She is a stand-in for a stereotype that we see now. Every day. It is generationally, it has taken on its own life as defining people. If there's a policy myth to be debunked, then after we debunk it, where do we place the responsibility for straightening this whole thing out? And so part of my whole thing was, if it is that easy to commit welfare fraud, shouldn't it be the policy's application and refinement as the focus, as opposed to scapegoating this entire swath of people to cover up that kind of incompetence? I mean, I know that you're not a policymaker, but, you know, we're just having a conversation about this.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And one interesting thing that I found in my research that was kind of interesting and surprising, at least to me, was that around the time of Linda Taylor becoming this infamous figure, that's when benefits in terms of real dollars started to drop. Mm. And so that was actually the high point in the mid-70s. And ever since then, the level of public aid benefits that folks are receiving has just been on the decline. And, you know, another interesting facet was that Reagan's main welfare architect when he was governor of California, who later came with him to the White House, was this guy, Robert Carlson. Mm-hmm. And he once noted that when they were in California, at least in the beginning, they didn't prosecute folks for committing welfare fraud just because the dollar amounts were so small and people were living on a very small amount of money. As we know, like, you're not getting rich off of food stamps or any other kind of public aid. And so if we put ourselves then back in the late 70s, welfare prosecutions are increasing in Illinois and across the nation, you know, I think in large measure because of the infamy of Linda Taylor and how much attention that case captured. At the same time, benefits are going down for people, and people are now being prosecuted for the same kinds of overpayments that were once treated just as an administrative matter is now being treated as a criminal matter in Illinois. In fact, after Linda Taylor is being treated as a felony. And so, yeah, I mean, I think if you look at all of those factors together, then it's hard to argue that the major issue or the major problem is the people on welfare, and you know, rather than the people who are making these policies.
As I stated at the top of this interview, much of the response to your piece from my most informed friends had to do with how extraordinary an example Linda Taylor is as an idiosyncratic sociopath becoming the stand-in for entire Black communities, and as sadly characteristic of an ingrained racist and sexist intersection we rarely check in this country. The myth seems drenched in the blood of an American-made racism, sexism, bigotry, capitalism, political incompetence and short-sightedness, epic CYA, and journalistic whorishness. These are those responses of the people from my neck of the woods to your piece. I have read several others on the right, on the left, and between. How do you think people are receiving your account of the life of Linda Taylor? And if anything, in the public discussion of this piece, what do you think people are missing?
Well, I just found it really interesting that people on both sides of the political spectrum found something that they could like or agree with in the story. I was actually very interested in what the conservative response was going to be. And I had some conservative folks who kind of disagreed with the conclusions that I came to at the end of the story about how, like you said, her example was extraordinary. And so the idea that she was used to create this stereotype was absurd. Like, I had people disagree with that. But I definitely had heard from people on the right who were very happy that I had confirmed that Reagan's story was true. They felt that this was vindication for the Gipper. And then I heard from people on the left who said, why did you write about this? This is going to embolden the right. Why didn't you write about Bank of America and corporate welfare and stuff like that? And so I think it's interesting because in the 70s, she was always seen, Linda Taylor, as somebody who Reagan or Reagan's critics, they could use her to make a point, to make a political point. And with this story, I think I was trying to fight back against that kind of narrative, the idea that an individual should be used as a symbol. But the response to it, I think people on both sides have actually, you know, they're continuing to fight over what she means and what she stands for. In some ways, that's a good thing. In some ways, it's a little, you know, makes me think that we haven't really gotten much past where we were back in the 70s, that it's just still like point scoring.
Because I think that's a part of my frustration. Like, you kind of get caught up in the cultural wars. The cultural wars are defining policies, and we have to be really clear about that. So I really did appreciate the fact that you had to point a finger strongly at these policies were shaped by racial morals and values of the time, and that for anybody on any side of the equation not to take that into account would probably lack some integrity. But I think that, you know, as a journalist on your end, in the way that you communicate, you often want to make a point, and you want that point to open a door to our greater selves. What do you hope at the end, after people, if people could figure out a way to settle down about being so committed to their stand, what would you kind of want them to get out of it about the human condition and how we respond to certain narratives? Let me take it this way. I wrote a piece on my blog when I saw the Central Park 5 documentary.
Yeah.
And I read a piece by Patricia J. Williams, a professor at Columbia University, also wrote a piece in response to it. And she was present during this trial, and many in the media called her for her perspective. And one of the things that she wrote in her piece was how all of the things that Burns had actually codified in the documentary that we are aghast at now, and we're looking at it now, and we're validating it now, she stated in the past. And it got under my skin because here you have a black woman who graduated from Wellesley, who graduated from Harvard, who at the time was a professor at Columbia, who clearly had the credentials, who clearly had the understanding, who clearly had integrity to respond to these things. She basically got shut out. So part of what I look at in the space that we occupy as folks who have a voice who can reach an audience is, how is it that we use our platforms to allow people to tell the stories that need to be told and for us to expand our notion of who should be a part of defining the narrative? Part of what troubled me as I was reading the article was the sense of, wow, this narrative was meticulously controlled by people who had the power to create a myth that has endured. And dare to say that even as brilliant as your piece is, it will likely not dislodge the notion from people's brains at this point in the near future that the welfare queen that we typify as a black woman living in the hood with multiple babies and multiple baby daddies, just living off the dole and driving a nice car and having fly gear, was actually not a black woman at all, right? So I think part of the question to you is, you know what the sides are saying, and if there were a middle piece where you wanted people to actually grow from places where they want to occupy because they feel comfortable and come to a middle, where would that middle be?
Well, you mentioned the fact that she wasn't actually a black woman. We hadn't even gotten to that.
Right.
That crazy part of the story.
Right.
Yeah, she was identified as white on the census when she was a kid, and white on her death certificate. So complicated racial identity there. But as far as the middle ground goes for the piece, what I set out to do, and can't deny that I certainly got a little preachy in the story at the end because I had some opinions that I wanted to get out there about what it all meant. But mostly the journalist, I believe in the show don't tell school, and the fact that people are coming to different conclusions about it, I don't necessarily see as a failure. I just see that as people coming to, if you tell people what to think, then I think that fewer people would read the story, or fewer people would be open to reading it. And my view on what it means, I think certain people will be open to that and certain people won't. But what I was trying to do was just lay out exactly who this woman was and what happened to her, what she did. And I think it's like pretty clear in the story how that diverged from what the narrative was, that what Reagan was saying or what was in the Tribune or what she was prosecuted for. Like, it's pretty stark. And I think if you read the piece and you read it with an open mind, then you'll see that. The problem is that the stereotype is just such a powerful, evocative one that it's really impossible to dislodge. And so thinking that my story would erase however many decades or centuries of stereotyping, it's not like really realistic. And so hopefully this will be like chipping away a little bit. And it's certainly it's certainly something that I hope will be read by people. And whenever the term gets cited, people will Google it and hopefully find the story.
And it'll have
an afterlife, and it'll just now be part of documentation of where this term came from, what it means, what it stands for. And so you know, if people want to complicate their view of it, it'll be there for them to read.
It's there. And another follow-up question. When you said that you had the reactions from the right and the left, how much did the notion of her not being black come into the conversation?
Not as much as you might think. I mean,
which is fascinating to me. This is the thing that, and I kind of got the sense of that when I was reading people's responses. I was like, that's really interesting. Nobody is talking about the fact that this woman was not black, right? And that in the way that we imagine the welfare queen, we imagine the welfare queen as a black woman.
Yeah, well, like everything in this story, it's like really weird and complicated. So she would actually portray herself as black at some points, and so she fed into the notion herself. At other points, she would portray herself as white. And so it's not as simple as saying, as you know, racial identity. It's not, you can't just say somebody's, that person's black and point at somebody who like has a certain skin tone. And it's just really weird. And
but
I think it's like one of the more fascinating things about her, certainly.
Yeah, but there is a certain power dynamic. If we are to assume that your work is correct, there is a very fascinating dynamic about a white woman being able to use her physical body and her physical appearance as a tool for power to get what she wants. As I'm not saying that other people have not done it, and I'm not saying that other people who are black have not done it. What I'm saying is, in this particular instance, it's kind of like this perfect storm of, if we talk about power dynamics based on race in this nation and in the world, having this intense origin within a very Eurocentric kind of paradigm, it is absolutely fascinating to me and to many of the people that I talk with about this, that this person who is and has been codified on her certificates both in death and in life, who is white, was able to maneuver her criminal activity in this way, but also becomes the person that kind of codifies this kind of the most caustic stereotype about black women historically in this country. It is amazing and it's fascinating, and I was wondering if anybody had delved into it. And it's probably a little too heavy and heady, actually, for a nation that has really never really dealt with any kind of real conversation about race in that way. So thank you so much for allowing me to explore that with you a little bit. Here are a couple of more questions that I have for you. Well, first of all, let me say this. After reading your piece and this conversation, I'd rather that the life of Linda Taylor be a documentary than a Hollywood movie.
Okay.
It just deserves, and I saw it cinematically as I was reading it. I was just like, oh my goodness, I could totally see this on the screen in front of me. I think it deserves the integrity of context and a lighter hand of an artist who is committed to respecting those left in the wake of her mess. And I'm not going to tell the whole article. I feel bad almost about telling the racial part, but being April, I have to talk about the race piece because that's very important to me. I want people to read this article. I want people to take the time to read this article. I know that it's long and we're in Twitter world and we're in the world where everybody has to distill an article in like 10 sentences, but it is absolutely worth the read. And by the way, Slate did such a beautiful job of laying it out and putting in the pictures. Bravo. Great job. Bravo.
I'm glad you said that. Yeah. A lot of people did a lot of great work on that.
Oh my God. You can tell it was so thoughtful. And you know, anytime you stop people in the middle of a busy holiday season and you get them to focus on it, it's just brilliant. So congratulations. But moving along, because I did my little research about you, I have a quick question for you as the one who codified the term shaggy defense with reference to the singer R. Kelly. I'm sure that you've noticed this uptick in discussion about R. Kelly and his alleged criminal behavior as of late, which I think is fascinating because it's been in the news and it's been popularly known and discussed for over a decade. I just wanted to get your thoughts about this current resurgence of this whole conversation around him.
Yeah, there's actually an R. Kelly, Linda Taylor connection. You'll be the first to know.
No.
Yeah. So Eugene Pencham, who is a famous Chicago lawyer, represented Linda Taylor, also was on the R. Kelly defense team.
Oh, wow.
But he died just before the child pornography trial started. So that's your R. Kelly welfare queen hookup right there. I think the R. Kelly stuff is really, really interesting. And when I covered his trial several years ago now, it was just crazy to me that there had been all this stuff, kind of similarly to Linda Taylor, all this stuff reported about him and all of these settlements that he'd paid to underage girls that were just basically being ignored because they didn't fit how people wanted to perceive this guy. And so it is just really interesting that there has been the resurgence, as you mentioned. And I think it's good for people to challenge themselves and think, like, why am I supporting this guy? I mean, I think the same thing about Chris Brown, you know, the way that we're able to compartmentalize artists and excuse their behavior we would find unforgivable if it happened, if they were doing it to somebody in our family or something like that, just because we happen to like their music. It's a strange cultural phenomenon, and I think the more airing the stuff gets, the better. There's a song, It Wasn't Me, by Shaggy, in which he tells a long accounting of the fact of, you know, him getting caught in flagrante delicto, as we say.
Right.
And explaining that even though there's, you know, very compelling evidence that he was the person who was caught having an affair, that it just wasn't him. That's his reasoning. It wasn't me. And, yeah, that was basically the defense in R. Kelly's trial, that even though it's clearly him in this video, you know, having sex with this underage girl, that was his defense. It wasn't him.
Right. Going back to my question to you at the beginning of this interview, do you feel that this article and the other work you produce honors your initial calling to this field?
Good question. I don't know if I felt like in the beginning I had a calling. I just wanted to find something that I like to do. I was more just being self-centered. I just wanted to make myself happy, and I enjoyed writing. But I think as I've gotten more experience and done more writing, I think I'm just on the lookout for stories of people that, you know, speak to something larger, you know, about how we live, what our culture is like, the beliefs that we have. And so, yeah, I think that the Linda Taylor story certainly fulfilled any ambition I might have had in those directions.
Okay. If you were not a journalist, who would you be?
Well, I always kind of wanted to be a doctor when I was growing up because I have that lineage in my family. But then I didn't like to get up early in the morning. And so all the doctors that I knew had to wake up early. And so the writers just seemed a little bit more rumpled and like you could just kind of sort of do your work on your own time. That appealed more to me.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, back to your sports hat. Who is going to win the Super Bowl and why? And my Ravens are out. My Patriots are still in. I have divided loyalties. It's very unpopular around my Baltimore people. But who do you think is going to win the Super Bowl and why?
I am a New Orleans Saints fan. And so I am a pessimist, so I will say it won't be the Saints. And, you know, Seattle has a huge home field advantage, the biggest in the NFL over the last several years, and so I think that they're going to come out of the NFC, and I think that since they'll make the Super Bowl, I'm less confident that any team in the AFC will make it through, so I'd have to definitely give Seattle the edge.
All right, cool. Josh, how can we find you on social media?
Twitter, I am Josh_Levine, Levin. Somebody got in before me with just the straight-up Josh Levine. So whoever that is, you can follow them, too. I'm sure they're cool.
That's
how people can find me.
Josh Levine, executive editor of Slate Magazine. Thank you so much for joining me on the AYG list. I look forward to reading more of your brilliant work and having you back in the future.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG List posts every Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at the AYG List. Also, visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thank you for listening.